from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum this morning, Harvard theoretical physicist Lisa Randall will join us to discuss her book, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, which challenges conventional wisdom about dark matter. She believes that dark matter is linked to the disappearance of the dinosaurs and ultimately to our appearance on the Earth. We'll talk to her about her book and the connection she draws between the science of dark matter and the importance of empathy. And that's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Dark matter, which scientists tell us surrounds us and doesn't absorb or emit light, is also believed to be the dominant form of matter in the universe with five times the energy of ordinary matter. It also may be, according to one of the world's leading experts on dark matter, linked to the mass extinction of 66 million years ago, which destroyed the dinosaurs and quite possibly allowed for the emergence of human species, that is, our human species. And that, in essence, is a primary hypothesis in Harvard physicist Lisa Randall's new book, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. The author of War Passages and Knocking on Heaven's Door, she was included in Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people back in 2007, and we welcome her to this morning's second Forum Hour.
Thanks for having me here.
Pleased to have you here. Let's go through this premise with a little detail here, if we could. So the comet, if it was a comet, something dislodged its orbit as the solar system passed through a disk of dark matter. And in that phase of the Milky Way, we had essentially dark matter, well, killing off the dinosaurs. That sort of sums it up. How do we come to such a hypothesis in the first place?
Let me take a step back for a minute and explain who I am, in the sense that I'm a physicist. I do theoretical physics, and I'm what's known as a model builder. You know, so we entertain different speculations about what could be possible in the world and maybe figure out how things are connected in ways that have eluded us so far.
Excuse me, you're also a cosmologist, though, right?
I am also a cosmologist.
And a particle physicist.
I do theoretical particle physics. So I think about the basic elements of matter, the basic structure of space, but also how things got to the way they are, which is what cosmology tells us, how the universe evolved. And in doing so, you think of different ways that matter can manifest itself and what type of matter there might be. And we weren't, I just want to be clear, we were not setting out to explain the extinction of the dinosaurs. It's just a lovely consequence, perhaps, of the kind of theory that we ended up coming up with. So my collaborators and I were actually thinking about some data that actually had arisen from the center of the galaxy. It looked like there were some photons more than could be explained by ordinary theories of dark matter. So we just asked a very simple question. We said, could dark matter be more concentrated than people think it is? We have this idea that dark matter surrounds us in this enormous spherical halo. But we had what seems like such a minor difference in the way we thought about it. We said maybe not all dark matter is the same. We said, look at our ordinary matter. There's all types of different particles. Maybe the same is true for dark matter, and maybe there's a fraction of it, a small fraction, maybe 5%, that interacts differently than the other dark matter. That is to say, maybe there is even dark light, like maybe it even experiences its own light, the way our matter experiences electromagnetism, but dark matter does not. Maybe the small fraction of dark matter does that. And what's really interesting in that case is that it can then radiate and cool down and form a disk like the disk of the Milky Way. So you actually end up with this 5% of the dark matter ends up in this concentrated disk. So whereas most of the dark matter is diffuse in this halo, there would be a very dense portion of the dark matter in this disk.
We're talking about something, though, that is speculative and
absolutely
hypothetical. What would be the importance, though? I mean, if it indeed the premise is a real one, and it certainly has some weight to it, that the extinction of the dinosaurs was necessary for human existence. We go through that whole chain of events and we come to that conclusion on the basis of what you've pretty much hypothesized.
So let's be clear here. So we actually know about the extinction of the dinosaurs independently of this research. There's, I mean, one of the things I found out when writing this book and wrote about a lot about it was there's a multiplicity of evidence. There's a lot of evidence that there was an enormous object that hit the Earth. And when I say enormous, like 10 to 15 kilometers big, you know, three times the width of Manhattan. You know, a really big thing hit the Earth, traveling maybe 40 kilometers per second, really fast, and collided with the Earth and caused a global extinction. It's known now as the KPG extinction. Then it used to be the KT extinction 66 million years ago. This happened, and there's a lot of evidence for it. There's a lot of evidence in the sense that you can actually see the extinction layer. You can see the difference where there's fossils and where there is. And you can also, I mean, the amazing thing is that at when this was proposed, no one had actually found the evidence of the object that hit, but after a little while, put together some evidence from actually a Mexican oil company that had actually found evidence of the crater in the Yucatan, which turned out to be where the impact happened. So we know about this impact, and it definitely triggered
the extinction.
Yeah. That's right. And then the question becomes, why did this impact happen? Now, it could just be random. We actually are hit by asteroids and sometimes comets all the time. Most of them are small. The question we asked is there any scientific evidence that there's actually something, some regularity, some periodicity in the large craters? The large craters being maybe bigger than 20 kilometers, ones where something bigger than a kilometer hit. And actually, there is some evidence in the data that it happens periodically. So what my collaborator, Matthew Rees, and I suggested was that as the solar system goes around the galaxy, which it does every 240 million years, it circulates around the center, it bobs up and down through the plane of the Milky Way. And that means every time it goes through the midplane, it's going to hit this disk of dark matter if it exists.
All right. I've got an email here from Craig who writes, and a fair point to make. He says, you need to explain dark matter. Most people don't know what it is.
Oh, good point. Okay. So dark matter. You actually did explain it pretty well in your little intro, which is to say that it's matter. It's stuff that gravitates like matter. It interacts with gravity like matter. It clumps into stuff. It's here in the galaxy. But the big difference is that it does not interact with light. A better name would have been transparent. Light just passes through it. It doesn't emit or absorb light. Dark stuff absorbs light. Dark matter is actually really transparent.
So a dumb question. How do we know it's there?
Well, we know it's there because of its enormous gravitational influence. There's a lot of it. So even though each individual dark matter particle, assuming it is a particle, interacts extremely weakly, the bulk of this dark matter, there's a lot of it, exerts gravitational influence. And in particular, even in our own galaxy, stars are traveling so quickly that they would fly out of the galaxy if there was not this enormous amount of additional matter that's not emitting or absorbing light that we don't see directly. But there's other ways we see it too. We see its effect on light. There's gravitational bending of light. We see it pass through when clusters of galaxies merge together. So there's lots of evidence that this dark matter exists, but it's all through its gravitational influence.
Talking to Lisa Randall, author of Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, I was saying to her before we went on the air that she has a very good way, in prose at least, of making a lot of this accessible to a lay audience. And I was reminded of Stephen Jay Gould, I guess was at Harvard before you, who used to be on this program repeatedly. And one time he was talking about why kids are fascinated by dinosaurs. You know that his quip was?
I don't know his quip, but I suggested in one of the chapters of my book, I have some ideas. So what did he say?
He said, they're big, fierce, and extinct, which is a good line, actually. What's yours?
That's good. Well, I actually have a little discussion just of, you know, I think that what people like is that they're enough like us that we can sort of appreciate them, but they're different enough to be weird and exotic, and they're big and they're small. They have feathers that they fly, they don't fly. I mean, there's just this enormous range, but it's all just a little bit deviant from what we're familiar with.
So a comet shoots out of its orbit and we lose the dinosaurs. Actually, we lose more than the dinosaurs. We lose, what, about 75% of the species?
Yeah, that's right. Three quarters of the life on the planet.
But how does human life come out of this then? This is so interconnected. Yeah,
right. It's actually an amazing story and we don't fully understand it. But what's really interesting is at the time of the dinosaurs, mammals were really small and actually they mostly lived underground. Large mammals didn't exist, maybe because dinosaurs laid eggs and they just had a reproductive advantage. We don't really know. But the fact is that once the dinosaurs were eliminated, and dinosaurs were big and they used a lot of resources, large mammals emerged. We don't know the direct connection, but it was only after the dinosaurs were gone that large mammals happened. And actually, that's one of the really interesting things just in the history of life on Earth, or at least complex life. There's, you know, we talk about evolution, we think of evolution as a gradual process, but there's also been five major mass extinctions where two-thirds to three-quarters of the species on Earth have disappeared. And it kind of resets the conditions for life.
I also think of Gould again, who thought that a lot of evolution was just accidental and capricious and almost random. But you've got a lot of paleontology and geology to kind of back you up here.
I did a lot of research. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's impressive. And the fact of the matter is, it does sort of, well, what made me brood a bit about the fragility of this little blue orb we're on, reading you, but also how interconnected we are, at least in this universe.
Right? Well, actually, you know, and this goes beyond this particular extinction. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was not just to promote this theory, which I like fully acknowledge is speculative, or even to promote the idea of dark matter. I think it's just really important for us on this planet to have a better sense of what it took to get us here. You know, what was the evolution of the universe? What was the evolution of the galaxy, of the solar system, and then of life? And I think understanding these connections, some of which are random, some of which are very deliberate, just helps us understand how fragile. I don't think life itself is fragile, but particular forms of life can be fragile. And so even when we get rid of most of the life on the planet, other forms of life emerge. But if we care about the life as it exists today, we should be thinking about what it takes to get us here.
Well, in fact, it gets us to empathy and David Foster Wallace and all kinds of fascinating things. But before we go even in that direction, let me highlight some things that you have written about dark matter that at least made sense to me as a layperson. You compared you know, bacterial cells in our bodies. We know they're there. Can't necessarily see them or touch them. And also, interestingly enough, internet communities outside of our awareness, which also makes sense. But then you talk about or write about meeting at Yahoo, of the Writers' Conference, a young African American who mentioned race.
Right. Actually, so when I was writing my book, I was trying to explain to people that there's just lots of things that you don't see in your daily lives, but they exist. And the history of physics is really finding those things, finding those invisible things. And but I was a little too daring, perhaps. And it's really interesting. It turns out when I was first writing my first chapter explaining dark matter, I actually did talk about race and our sometimes how we just walk through and don't see other cultures or other. And my friends wisely said, you know, this is kind of confusing. Maybe you should take this out and use something a little simpler. So I changed it. And I talked about bacterial cells that we don't see, 10 times more bacterial cells than ordinary cells, but most of the time we're unaware of them, or internet communities we don't see. And I did a reading at this artist community named Yaddo. And the day I was leaving, which was the next day.
I said Yahoo, didn't I? It's Yaddo.
It's okay. It's okay. But the day I was leaving.
There may be a Freudian reason for saying Yahoo, but internet communities.
There we go. Exactly. And also, most people don't know the word Yaddo, so it's fair enough. But he walked up to me and said, I have a question. It seems kind of crazy, but were you really talking about race? And which was, I was flabbergasted because I had taken out every reference to race. But he understood that when we're talking about the things that, you know, we tend to give dominance to the things that we see that directly, the things that we're familiar with. And we sometimes neglect all these other communities or aspects of the world or existence that are important to us. And so I was just amazed. And we've actually become good friends since then. And I ran this piece by him. And so I think it's just a very interesting thing to think about when we think about science, because a lot of people, you know, I talk about very abstract ideas. Another reason I was really happy to write this book was to be able to connect things that are so abstract, like the elementary particles I work on, which are abstract to people, to a lot of what is more immediate to us. And this opportunity just was really important to me. And because I realized a lot of the time when I'm talking about this, people almost don't even think it exists. They don't even think it's real because they don't see it or they don't care about it. But the point is that we should care about it and that it is important. And just the fact that we as human beings don't directly experience it every day doesn't make it any less relevant to the world as a whole.
Well, it's very relevant. In fact, I think you kind of intimate dark matter may be the key to the universe, or at least this universe. We can talk about string theory of maybe other universes or parallel universes. But where does empathy come in? Explain that, because it does come in your book, yeah.
So it comes in the sense, so we're jumping around a little bit here, but I want to just be clear that it's sort of this notion. So I was teaching a freshman seminar, And it was really, they're a wonderful class. So freshman summer, you have 15 students, and people are free to talk. And they're freshmen, and they're open-minded. And the students were saying, we don't understand why not everyone wants to learn about this amazing physics that I talk about, where we're talking about different scales and what's going on at the scale of elementary particles. And it was really interesting to me because they thought about it for a while, and they said, you know, in some ways it's like empathy that people don't appreciate because it's not directly their world. A world of an atom, the world on the scale of the Higgs boson, the world on the scale of quantum mechanics, it's not what we experience daily. And that tends to make people think quantum mechanics, those rules aren't real, but they are real. It's just not what we experience in our daily lives. And one of the challenges that I have as an author writing about these things is to make them more real, to say why this is important to us, why it is relevant, and why this is really what's happening at these scales.
You talk about, this almost is a religious perspective, too?
I don't think I would call it a religious experience. In fact, I'd probably say it's the opposite. But what I do think is that
I'm talking about the vastness and interconnectedness.
But I think the feelings that we experience, you know, I think people have a deep sense of satisfaction sometimes in sort of a religious belief or in understanding things. And so I think that kind of deep sense of satisfaction when I personally or when my colleagues understand connections we didn't understand before, understand how things got here. I mean, you know, we tend to focus a lot on the things that we don't understand as scientists, but it is remarkable how much we understand about the universe. I mean, we understand its age, 13.8 billion years. We understand what's happened, how it's evolved. We understand how structure began to form, how dark matter started to collapse and ordinary matter came with it to give us galaxies and galaxy clusters. There's an enormous amount that we have learned in the last century. And I find that just really satisfying in a deep way that I wouldn't say is religious, but some people would associate with sort of a religious kind of sense, maybe.
Well,
but
I've read about you talking about religion. Walks on the beach and looking at mountains and,
Well, so that's, you know, again, that's more my, I mean, you know, I was joking with you before we started that, you know, Stephen Jay Gould and I both came from Fresh Meadows. It was a planned community. You didn't really get to walk on the beach there. It was, you know, there were playgrounds, there was grass, but it was all very manicured. I mean, when I actually go out in the outdoors now, I love the idea that of where these things came from, looking at limestone cliffs and understanding that this was, you know, this is fossils from millions of years ago, to really appreciate more where the stuff on Earth came from. And, you know, we tend to forget that because we tend to see what's man-made so much so that we lose track of how the universe has evolved to this point. And I think it's really fun and interesting and important for us to go back and realize where all of the stuff that's here came from. And even things like the fact that some of the elements we see on Earth might have come from comets or asteroids hitting us, that, you know, to really understand how we're connected to the rest of the universe as well.
Talk about that a little more. I mean, how does this help us understand perhaps or how does this provide wisdom for us or understand maybe the future of our planet and where it's headed and all that?
Well, I think it's a tall order to answer that in one fell swoop, but I do think just like in every other situation, it's good to understand how things got created before you understand where you're going forward with them. I think also just the pace at which they happen is important. I mean, this is billions and millions of years of history that we're talking about. And one thing that we can see for sure is that we are very rapidly changing the face of this planet. And we're using resources at a rate that we've never used them before. And so I think just even comparing the rate at which we change things and just how there can be all these unanticipated consequences is one cautionary note when we go forward in the world.
And we're talking to Lisa Randall, Harvard professor, particle physicist, theoretical physicist, and author of Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. And you write about cosmetology and cosmology, etymological. I must confess I was fascinated by that. Where does that lead us?
So, I mean, so we're jumping around because there really is a lot of stuff in the book. And one of the things I like to do in the book is
jump around.
Saying that. Don't think I'm being confusing. But it's just, I like to jump around too. And I liked, and so
I like
what
a big
canvas
too. Yeah.
And exactly. And what I was going to say is that in the book, I also try to make cultural references and refer back to actual experiences. But this was just sort of joking that, you know, a couple of times, this is actually true. People, when I said I was a cosmologist, I think once in customs, someone said, you're a cosmetologist. And I thought that was a little bit odd because it was so far removed from anything I would think about. But I actually looked up the words. And the great thing was that it talks about, both of them come from the word cosmos. And it's talking about order and beauty. And I love the fact that, you know, when you think about cosmetology and you think about the universe, you're thinking about order and beauty. I thought that was kind of hilarious.
So let me jump again. Where do you come down in terms of string theory, or do you?
So I prefer in my research to really focus on things that we can test or understand or connections that we can make. So you might say, well, we're not testing the dinosaur theory, but actually this dark disk that I talk about, there is actually a satellite that is measuring a billion stars, their position and velocity, and that we'll be able to observationally tell whether or not the dark disk I suggested exists. So I prefer that kind of thing. That doesn't mean that I don't bring in a lot of theoretical ideas. And those of your listeners who've read War Passages know I talk about string theory and I talk about the connections of very different ideas I worked on having to do with extra dimensions of space to string theory. And it's perfectly fine to think about what's the underlying theory. But in my research, I prefer to think a little bit more about what we've observed and how to make those connections. But some of the work I do can have implications for string theory.
I think it does. String That's theory. Why I asked you. I mean, I've had Brian Greene on and Leonard Susskind, and, you know, there are connections here again, interconnectedness and so forth. Talk about your team, though. I mean, how many of you are there in your research team?
You know, it varies, and sometimes I'll work with people even at other universities, but I usually work with a few postdocs and a few students. It's relatively small. It's theoretical work, and I like to be involved, but right now it's a lot of fun every time I get to go home, and we're working on some pretty interesting papers right now, so about dark matter.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join this conversation. Obviously, I know there are many of you probably have questions about dark matter, but also about this whole thesis hypothesis that Lisa Randall's working with here. She's the author also of War Passages, and her new book is called Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. There have been a lot of theories advanced about why the dinosaurs became extinct. This is one of those theories, and be interested to hear what those of you listening have to say about it. And you're certainly welcome to join the conversation as we continue to jump around here with this big canvas. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome your calls. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And there are a number of other ways you can join this program. You can go to our Facebook page, but you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We do welcome your involvement. So, again, feel free to join us. And I should give you a plug here, Lisa. You're going to be at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center, and you'll be there at 7 p.m. tonight. And tomorrow, 7 p.m., there's a talk and book signing at the bookshop in Santa Cruz. But please feel free to join the program again, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org. Getting some emails in here, and we'll get to as many of you as we can. Lots of interest in this, and Higgs boson, no surprise there either. You did an e-book on that, didn't
you? I did.
Yeah, we had a conversation about it when the discovery occurred, and we'll have a whole conversation here. Who knows how many jumps we'll take in the course of this hour. Stay tuned.
I do have a lot of stuff in there, so that's fair.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Harvard theoretical physicist Lisa Randall is with us discussing her book, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs. And she thinks that dark matter is linked to the disappearance of the dinosaurs and ultimately humans' appearance on Earth. And we're talking about her book and the connection she draws between the science of dark matter and the importance of empathy. She'll be at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco tonight at 7 p.m. and tomorrow at 7 p.m. There's a talk and book signing at Bookshop in Santa Cruz. And I'm going to go to a few emails here before I go to your calls. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. And here's Maria who writes, I mentioned Higgs boson, so let's, because you did an e-book on this, and I said it's in our archives. We did a whole program on it. 60 Minutes recently covered the collider that discovered the God particle, the Higgs boson, and it seems there's evidence that this concentrated dark matter that's not actually empty could contain other dimensions. Is it possible there are other worlds existing side by side with us that we simply cannot detect with our own senses, like a dog hears a frequency that we can't hear, like how we know gravity exists even though we can't see it?
Yeah, and I talk a lot about that actually in my first book, War Passages. I actually have done research dealing with about the consequences or possible consequences of an extra dimension of space. And again, one of the interesting things is that if it does have implications for particle physics and the Higgs boson, there are experimental signs that they are looking for today, even at the collider. But yes, it's very possible that these other universes exist. We won't necessarily know about them.
It's like bacteria again. You know, we didn't know that whole universe of bacteria existed, but there it was.
Well, that's right. And I think that's really important to focus on, that, you know, people get very caught up in multiverses. But let's think about all the multiverses that are right here that we don't see, that we don't appreciate, because those are places where we're really going to make progress. And as scientists, that's really what we want to do.
We don't even know what's in the depths of our ocean, for example. I mean,
exactly.
Everybody talks about space, but we haven't even gone
exactly.
down.
Exactly. We want to look for life on other planets, but we don't actually know what all life looks like here. I think that's a good point.
Here's Ben, who writes, if dark matter doesn't interact with light, what happens when a photon hits it?
It goes right through. And in fact, it's going right through. Dark matter is going right through you now.
Right as we speak.
Yeah. And billions of dark matter particles go through every second if dark matter is made up of particles. And so light just goes right through it. It's just like neutrinos go right through things. It just really, if it doesn't interact, it's just going to go through.
David writes, I'd like to ask your guest, as someone steeped in science and with the expertise to understand much of the underpinnings of our universe, what is your reaction to comments from people like Ben Carson, you know this may go to politics, mm-hmm. about creation and science? Are we doomed with potential leaders like this? Well, that you can't predict. You're not a soothsayer. But what do you think when you hear a politician running for president of the United States who talks about creationism?
You know, I mean, I think the really upsetting thing to me is how much more comfortable politicians are talking about God than they are talking about science. I mean, science is really how our society is advancing technology, but yet they're afraid to do that. People can talk about their beliefs. I'm not going to stop someone from talking, but I do think there is some obligation as leader of the country to pay attention to actually things that we know and what we've learned and what the consequences can be. Seems like that would be a good step moving forward.
And this is a neurosurgeon who has studied science, who may be rejecting evolution.
Have you talked to your surgeons? They're kind of you know, they're jocks. Surgeons are jocks. They're not always they're not always the deepest thinkers. Let's face it.
I have a friend who's a surgeon. He says, I'm a mechanic, basically. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I like my surgeon. I like a good surgeon that's doing lots of operations. They're the best surgeons. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they understand everything about the world.
Well, but you were talking about the frightful things about that. The frightful thing is how many people resonate to that idea of creationism and the dismissal of evolution and say, this is my candidate because he's on God's side.
So, you know, I talk about this in my book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. Like, why is this? And I don't really know the answer, but I think that people want to feel that they can participate, that they have some control. I mean, one of the reasons I actually think it is important to write books like I do is that I think people feel very disconnected a lot of the time from the advances that are happening. Sometimes they're too complicated to understand. Sometimes they seem like people just wanting to advance their own agenda. And I think it's very important for them to understand how it fits into what's going on in the world, how important all these developments are to actually many of the conveniences of their life, but also that it's important for education. It's important to understand as human beings. And this gets lost a lot of the time in the discussion. And in part, I think, because the material seems scary, or it seems like, you know, if you look at the way news that science is reported in newspaper, it's often reported as this scientist said this rather than the actual science behind it. And at that level, why should they believe it more than anything else? So
well,
I think
you're talking
it is important.
About a major concern about scientific literacy, really, aren't
and
you?
And so, but also the way it's presented. So I think, I mean, so if there is any role of the kind of work I'm doing when I'm writing these books, I think it is important to give people, at least who want to understand things, the opportunity to understand them.
Well, you're an educator.
And a researcher. I think of myself as a researcher.
But you are, you're a teacher too, aren't you?
Yes, but I think it's also important to
and
realize
your books
that
are
we're
teaching.
Trying to. Absolutely, but they're also, I also like to think of them as creative projects in and of themselves, because I like to bring together all these different ideas in new ways, which I think is a form of creativity as well.
All right, we're going to go to your calls in just a moment. Just one quick email from Maria, who says, could you explain dark matter as a metaphor by relating it to something here in our world rather than talking about its properties in space, which I think we did when we said, you know, mm-hmm. bacteria in the internet. But then she mm-hmm. says, what would happen, though, for example, if we brought dark matter to Earth? How would it act on Earth?
Dark matter is here on Earth. It's going right. through us. It doesn't do, I mean, again.
I guess she's thinking about dark matter coming down and killing the dinosaurs or something along those lines.
Well, again, dark matter is only influential when there's a whole lot of it and when it's dense and it exerts its gravitational influence. So it's a good question. You might say there's five times the energy in dark matter than ordinary matter. Why are we so concerned with ordinary matter? Well, the reason is because it has other interactions which are, in fact, much more powerful. You might not think of electromagnetism as very powerful, but it's, you know, 40 orders of magnitude more powerful than gravity when you get two electrons together. So basically, these other interactions make ordinary, and also because it's collapsed into the Milky Way disk in our immediate vicinity, it is denser. But that doesn't mean there isn't a whole lot of dark matter nearby. It just means that it's not having any immediate effect on you or me. It is, however, the dark matter that's in our galaxy is, as I said, keeping it together. It's keeping stars that are going at a particular speed rotating in our galaxy. Otherwise, they would fly off.
And we'll go to our calls. We go first to Edna. Good morning.
Good morning. I hope this is not a non sequitur type of a question, but I'm wondering what kinds of interdisciplinary efforts are being made, and are you working at all with climatologists on addressing things like global warming that are, you know, challenging us right here and now? Is there any kind of interaction between these different groups of scientists? You know, one working in this highly theoretical I don't know what to call it, a realm versus, you know, people who are.
It's a good question. And there are some forms of science that really have brought together many people. I mean, one of the reasons I really love the story of how figuring out how the dinosaurs were killed, and again, 3/4 of the species on the planet, was because of the way it brought together physicists, chemists, geologists, paleontologists, biologists, just to really understand what had happened. And there really are focused efforts sometime. In terms of climate and energy, it certainly does bring in a lot of disciplines. The kind of theoretical work that I do is actually far removed from the kind of things that are happening. I mean, in my book, I'm certainly thinking about those kinds of things, and I think I can make people aware of it by thinking about the history of the planet and the many connections that were required to get things the way they are. But in terms of the immediate consequences of what's happening on the planet today, there are physicists involved, but they're physicists working at sort of lower energies, at sort of different level of complexity than the one that I'm facing, that I deal with in my research.
Edna, thank you kindly for the call. We're going to go to more of your calls, and let's go next to Nicasio. Mike, join us. You're on the air.
Great. Thank you. Good show. I've always wondered how the ancients, the Greeks, were able to ascertain rudimentary atomic structure without any of the instruments and sensitizing devices that we have today. And when I mean rudimentary, of course, we've gone so much further in terms of the structure in the proton and the other particles.
So this is actually a really interesting question. So, you know, so atoms, according to the Greeks, were supposed to be unchanging, indivisible objects. So they had the idea that there was a small component, but they were unchanging and indivisible. How do we actually know about atoms? Well, the way we know about atoms is precisely because they change and because they're divisible. They radiate. That was one of the reasons we knew about them. And they're divisible, as you know, into the nuclei and the electrons around them. And those components have been discovered. So when we talk about atoms today, it actually is a very different notion of atoms than the Greeks had. And in terms of asking that question, you know, there aren't that many possibilities. Either there's going to be small objects of which things are made, or it's sort of all fundamental. It's kind of those are the choices. So I think it was great that they were speculating about that. But actually, our notion of atoms, that we use the word atom, is extremely different than what the Greeks had in mind.
Thank you for the question, Mike. Good to hear from you. We hear next from David up in Napa, who is a physicist. David, welcome.
Yes, good morning. Just a touch of clarity here about Ben Carson. He's a neurosurgeon. Who said he's a scientist? I mean, it's certainly not nuclear physics or particle physics or any of those. So I think I don't know who's selling him as a scientist, but he's not a scientist. He's an accomplished surgeon. That's all.
Well, you got to study science to become a surgeon or a doctor.
Yeah, well,
and that
yeah.
is more or less what we were saying earlier. We said that there's no reason to assume right. that he understands all of science.
I should say not. You know, that because I'm a scientist, that doesn't make me a neurosurgeon, I can assure you.
Well, you can practice on the side, David.
But at any rate.
A lay neurosurgeon. There you go. Yeah.
Okay. Lisa, I don't. It sounds like you may have read Emmanuel Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision. Have you read that?
I have not.
No, but I have. Yeah. What's the connection you're making, David?
Well, there's some specific dates in there. Say, for instance, midnight of the 23rd of 687 BC, there was a great cosmic disturbance recorded by the Chinese, which happened to be the same date of the Passover. Quite a coincidence.
To the extent that we actually know this historically. I actually do. I have a whole chapter where I talk about stuff that hit the Earth, including which we don't always know if it's asteroids or comets. And it is actually really interesting to take a record of the things that have hit. And some of them do seem to coincide with significant events. I mean, I think that's very speculative, even more speculative than my theory a lot of the time. But I think it is interesting, though, to look at what we do. And actually, another thing that's really interesting is how long it took to really convince the scientific community that stuff really was falling from space. You know, the people that were seeing it were, you know, in general, farmers out in the field. And, you know, they had some crazy observations and they had some real observations. And it took a little while before people really believed that some of the stuff that was happening was genuine. I mean, it sounds so crazy, you know, stuff hitting us from space, but it really does happen. And so it's interesting to actually look at the statistics now and see how much stuff actually does come into our atmosphere from space.
Oh, we thank you, David, for the call. It's actually kind of scary. I mean, you know, a lot of people see these things falling and have traditionally seen them as UFOs or whatever. But the fact of the matter is we could be hit any time by an asteroid or a comet.
Well, but the fact is, it's only a big one that you really should be scared about. And I think, as many of your listeners have pointed out, we have a lot more immediate concerns, I say, on the planet. I think it is important, though, to think about what can hit the Earth. And I think there are some interesting studies to try to at least categorize the asteroids that are nearby. But it is challenging, but it's great scientifically to learn more about what's out there.
It's also fascinating to study these extinctions and realize that, you know, they're incontrovertible, really. 66 million years ago, there was an extinction.
That's right. And actually, one of the ones that's really interesting is the Permian-Triassic, where 95% of the species disappeared. And actually, one thing we do know is that there was a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at that time. And actually, there are other conditions that actually have a disturbing resemblance to some of the things happening now. So I think that there is something to be said for trying to learn from the past as well.
Absolutely. And another, we'll learn from our callers, perhaps. Peter, you're on.
Hi. Two quick questions. To better comprehend dark matter as a layman, can you explain experimental? First, can you explain if do you think they comprise atoms? You know, conventional matter.
So the one thing that we pretty much know for sure is that dark matter is not made up of atoms. Because if it was made up of atoms, it would be made up of charged particles ultimately, and it would interact with light. And so far, we've seen no evidence that interacts with light. I mean, it could be very, very tiny, but it would be such a tiny level that it cannot be made up of atoms.
Can you explain, then, an experimental test to demonstrate why you can't see it? I mean, can you bombard it with something in a Large Hadron Accelerator that could simulate?
So I talk about the ways that we try to look for dark matter. So we have to distinguish two things. One is dark matter's existence at all, which has to do with its gravitational effects. And we know dark matter exists as matter. Then there's another question, which is, what is dark matter made of at a more fundamental level? Is it elementary particles? And if so, what are the properties of those particles? What are their masses? What are their charges? And to do that, you have to look for the individual particles. And one way, there's several different approaches to this problem. One way experimenters look for dark matter is to have large vats of stuff. And the hope is that even though we've so far seen no interaction with ordinary matter other than gravitational, maybe there's a tiny one, and I can give you reasons why we think that might be the case. If there's a tiny, tiny interaction, if you have enough atoms of ordinary matter, there's a chance that when dark matter comes in, it will have a slight recoil off that ordinary matter, and you can see a tiny bit of energy that happens because of that interaction. And so there are searches, they're called direct dark matter searches. There are some really fantastic experiments made at xenon, for example, now. There's a Berkeley and other experiments called CDMS, which is using more solid state detection, where they're looking for these very, very tiny effects that you can have potentially if dark matter has a tiny interaction with matter.
And Peter, we thank you for your call. A lot of questions coming in
ordinary
about dark matter. Let me go to a few of them. Rick wants to know, Well, he emails the following. Science reexamines itself. So why, if it's transparent, has the dark matter label stuck? If transparent matter is not a term with cachet or brevity, why not call it clear matter?
Great question. I challenge you to try to get the name changed. I think people actually like the name dark matter, too, because it sounds so exotic and it's kind of fun and people and the name is stuck. I think it is true, though, that, you know, I actually joke. I mean, you know, we've talked about all the detours I take in my book. One of the things I do talk about is astronomical names and how confusing a lot of the astronomical names are, because a lot of the astronomical names are based on what people thought originally rather than what we know things are. So, you know, we'll talk about planetary nebula, even though they have nothing to do with planets. And, you know, there's, you know, population three stars are actually the first stars because they're the last ones that we are hoping to discover. So so I think we end up with names that are sometimes confusing and misleading. And so it doesn't mean we can't understand things, but it's important to keep in mind what they actually mean. And I kind of agree with you, but it's not going to happen, I'm afraid.
Another email. Gregory writes, how does dark matter fit in with standard model supersymmetry?
Well, that's an interesting question, and that's a little bit related to the direct dark matter searches that I talked about. It may or may not be related. First of all, let's keep in mind we have not yet discovered supersymmetry, which is an idea for what could underlie
what
the standard model
of
particle
is, yeah.
physics. Yeah, it postulates that for every particle we know about, there's sort of an associated partner particle. We've seen no evidence of those partner particles yet, although the Large Hadron Collider, this giant proton collider near Geneva, is looking for that. But there's no evidence yet. But if supersymmetry is in fact there, there's a particle that has very little interactions that could be a suitable dark matter candidate.
We'll push back here, okay? Reed writes, why is it that physicists seem to be trying to create a new kind of religion? Science is supposed to be about experimentation and facts, not about wild speculation built on top of speculation built on top of speculation.
Well, I think I've tried to be very, very clear that the stuff I'm doing is based on observations, and also we try to find out ways to test things. So yes, some scientists do that, but not all of us do. And it gets harder as we talk about more theoretical, more abstract things. But almost by definition, the scientists are going to be exploring frontiers. It's going to be the place where it's hard to test things. And one of the reasons I think the research that I do as a model builder is so important is that it's very hard to find things that you don't know you're looking for. And, you know, you think about that in your daily life all the time. You can overlook stuff a lot unless you're targeting it. And having models allows you to target it. One of the reasons this dark disk research is important is whether we, independent of our research, there is this Gaia satellite that is measuring the position and velocities of stars in our galaxy. And it's very interesting to know, can you look for this dark disk? What does that data say about it? And the only way to answer that question is to postulate the disk and figure out what the consequences would be.
Here's John, who writes on our website, Randall seems to be viewing our current theoretical framework through a somewhat positivistic theory of objective reality. What is her epistemology? The history of science is full of radical changes and paradigms, dramatic revisions, abandoning of prominent theories, etc. Aren't abstractions such as dark matter essentially constructs that help us explain some of the more bizarre observations we have yet to explain otherwise?
So, and actually in my previous book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, I talk a lot about the notion of what's known as an effective theory. It's a very important notion for a physicist, but I think it's an important notion actually throughout everything. I mean, the point is that, and this has to do with what we can observe at some level. We have theories that work at the scale we can observe things. So let's take an example. Newton's law is telling me what happens when I throw a ball. Now, you know, when I was in high school, I remember my high school teacher teaching us Newton's laws and then saying they're wrong. And the fact is, they're not wrong. They work. But at certain scales or at certain levels of precision, you can see that there are underlying theories, namely special relativity or quantum mechanics. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It means that it applies over a certain range. And if in that range we can only measure certain things, I mean, you'd be crazy to use quantum mechanics to try to figure out what happens to a ball because you'd never see the difference in any observation. So you might as well think of it as Newton's laws applying. And so I tend to think sort of conditionally in that way. So dark matter certainly seems to exist. I mean, it completely explains a lot of the observations that we've seen. And I don't know anything else that does. Does that tell me that ultimately underlying everything, there won't be another theory? Well, it's possible, but it's not going to help me advance my science right now.
Here's another comment. David, we just keep these going here. Is it possible, he writes, that dark matter is an explanation of phenomena that our theories of gravity otherwise do not account for? The point being, Is it not possible that our theories are simply wrong, and rather than posit something else to make them work, we should perhaps abandon the theories and come up with something else?
So here's my attitude about this, which might not agree with everyone's attitude. So first of all, it's a much, much more radical change to say the theory is wrong than to say that there's this new type of matter. After all, why should all matter be like the matter that we experience in our daily lives? If anything, I think it's amazing that the matter that we know about constitutes as much as 15% of the matter in the universe. I mean, we are just random human beings.
You know what's popping into my head here? I may mean nothing, but as often is the case, but I can't help wondering about the analogy to, we talk about Euclidean geometry and we learn it and we accept and so forth, but there's non-Euclidean geometry, and that's a reality.
And there's lots of realities that we don't directly experience. And so why should the fact that we're made up of atoms, why should everything in the universe be made up of atoms? It seems to me it's just a lot of hubris to think that everything would be made up of the same stuff we are. And so if anything, I think what's amazing is that we are as significant a fraction. That is to say, the matter we know about constitutes as much a fraction of the energy of the universe as it does. You know, changing the laws of gravity is very radical. Assuming that some matter that we haven't not detected seems almost obvious to me.
I had a tweet here from a listener named Kit who tweets, how would you hypothesize order and beauty and entropy slash chaos figuring into the effect of dark matter on humans or the universe? Well, there's an easy question, right?
Like I said, I think it's nice to have theories that you can put together to make nice predictions. And dark matter works beautifully to explain a lot of observations that are made. I mean, that might not be the most satisfying answer you have that you would want. But actually, it's quite orderly. And one of the really nice things about our theories with dark matter is that we can now understand how structure in the universe formed, how galaxies form. People model what dark matter would do, and it turns out to match pretty well, at least on larger scales.
Well, Rob writes, I read the New York Times story on Einstein's disowned theory about spooky action at a distance and still don't understand how particles get entangled. How?
Well, this is, again, a feature of the fact that you do not live at the scale of an atom and quantum mechanics is not familiar to you. This really has to do with understanding the underlying postulates of quantum mechanics, which says that particles can be produced in pairs with certain what's called phase relations. It's a way, it's something that makes sense from the point of view of quantum mechanics, from classical mechanics. It seems more disconcerting. And so a lot of the time, so people have known about this for years, by the way. This is not new things, even though New York Times has reported. I mean, you know, people keep trying to find ways to try to say maybe there's some classical explanation, not quantum mechanical explanation. But the fact is, quantum mechanics is the more fundamental theory. We experience the world according to classical laws, but that doesn't negate the underlying efficacy of quantum mechanics. And so what these experiments are doing is trying to say, is there some classical interpretation? And lo and behold, there isn't. It seems to be quantum mechanics is right.
Michael writes, very interesting topic. What is the most useful light frequency you employ for your research? I told you we jump all over here.
I'm a theorist, so that's probably not the best question. It's the same frequency that you're using every day in your life. I mean, I'm just reading and writing and using the computer.
Well, we'll go to more calls here. Let me go to Tim. Tim, thanks for waiting. You're on.
So I wanted to ask Dr. Randall. I read in a popular science book, sorry, I don't know the source, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, about the idea that mass extinctions might have a periodicity to them. And it even mentioned the idea that this might be connected to motion through the galactic plane. And I wondered, for one, how strong that evidence is for periodicity, and also if you could comment on the history of that idea and if there have been
right.
Other,
so that's actually what I talk about.
Explanations proposed.
Right. So that's a big feature in my book, and I have a whole chapter about this. And so there's two things that we have to separate. One is periodicity in extinctions, and one is periodicity in just stuff hitting the Earth. So in my research, I concentrate on stuff hitting the Earth because extinctions have so many different causes. As I said, it could be something hit the Earth. It could be volcanoes. It could be carbon dioxide from other sources. Having said that, there is still evidence in the data that there are periodic extinctions with something like 26 and 52 million year periods. It seems to be surviving. The evidence for periodicity in the crater record, again, it has to do with large craters. Small objects hit all the time. And that's one of the things that my collaborator and I did our research on. Now, the evidence there was marginal. There's papers that say it exists. Then there's other papers saying where the statistics are wrong. The fact is, we don't have a whole lot of craters that are big from, say, the last 250 million years or 500 million years, because some of them land in the ocean, some of them erode. It's just, you know, the record is sparse. So you have to take this limited statistical data and try to figure out what's going on. One of the reasons Matt and I liked having a model is we can get slightly better statistical evidence because we can sort of predict the period better. And you're absolutely right that we were not the first people to think about the solar system going through the plane of the galaxy. The problem was that the period was wrong. If you actually looked at just ordinary matter in our galaxy, you get periods more like 55 or 60 million years rather than the roughly 30 million year period that both of these other things support. And the other thing is it wasn't episodic enough. The Milky Way, is, even though there is this galactic plane, the solar system isn't going through radically different environments of ordinary matter. So the dark disk actually solves both those problems, because with the dark disk, you could get a shorter period. And furthermore, you have this very short period of time because the disk is thin when the solar system is going through. And so we use this to suggest an explanation for these periodic impacts, which is why we think one of them could have been the one 66 million years ago that caused this extinction.
Well, fascinating stuff. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. That was a wide-ranging discussion. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it as well. Lisa Randall, professor of science at Harvard, author of Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. We're going to conclude here with a quote that Ian sent us on our Facebook page. Ian writes, I'm reminded of Carl Sagan's quote, we're made of star stuff, we are a way for the cosmos to know itself. Thank you for being with us again. And by the way, she'll be at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco tonight at 7 and tomorrow at 7. There's a talk and book signing at Bookshop Santa Cruz. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Katrina Vandenhoevel, who is the editor of Nation Magazine, will be with us in the opening hour tomorrow. In our second hour, we're going to talk to the head of the San Francisco Opera. Please stay tuned for all that. And thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.